Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I am your host, Monica Hadley, and with me down the road, remotely, is my mother, Caroline Kilborn.
Hello, everyone.
And, you know, winter's hitting Iowa today. We had our reprieve yesterday. Beautiful 70-degree weather, and now it's freezing and raining and possibly snowing and, windy and just... Our guest today is Frank Toms, author of Behind the Red Veil, An American Inside Gorbachev's Russia. Frank was a teacher for, he just told us 50 years, although his bio says after 40 years as a teacher and 12 as a consultant and keynote speaker, Frank Toms became a writer, publishing 4 books, Teaching from the Middle of the Room, Inviting Students to Learn in 2010, and 3 more, Teaching That Matters, Engaging Minds, Improving Schools, that's one title, Exciting Classrooms, Practical Information to Ensure Student Success is another title, and Listening is Learning, Conversations Between 20th and 21st Century Teachers. He spent the majority of his teaching career with 8th graders in public and private schools in New Hampshire and Massachusetts. He coached soccer and hockey, directed an educational consortium, had his own dark room, and did a whole bunch of other stuff. For the past 9 years, he's lived with his wife in San Miguel de Allende, Mexico, where he continues to write, joined a philosophy group, mentors university students, and is a member of a book group. And this book, Behind the Red Veil, An American Inside Gorbachev's Russia, is a memoir. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Frank.
Well, thank you very much, Monica.
So, you're writing about a time 30 years ago or so?
Yeah, the last from 1985 to 1991, I spent time in the last days of the Soviet Union under Gorbachev, and it was a perfect time for an American to venture on his own a lot of the time in that country at that time. It was a wonderful, wonderful experience.
Wow. And tell us a little bit about why you were so drawn to Russia.
Well, it started in fourth grade when I saw My Weekly Reader wall maps with the big red Soviet Union on it. And then a couple of years later, seeing red China also, and the only color on the map was red. And it got me wondering, what is this all about? It's so big and it's so dominant. And then when I read about Alexander Belsky and Thomas Edisinsky as the Russian inventors of the telephone and the light bulb, I was intrigued. So what do you mean they invented the light bulb and all that? So it tweaked my mind. And then in college, I had stunning lectures on Russian czars with my professor, Robert Waite, at Williams College. And I just had a sort of in the back of my mind a sense of there's something here in this Russian life, because I'm basically an Anglophile, Scotch, Irish, Welsh, and English. And in my second year of teaching in 1963, I was in it quite a while ago, my mentor and department head, Dale Goodwin, asked me to teach 8th graders, moved down from the 9th grade European history that I taught in my first year, to teach 8th graders about South Africa, South America, and Russia. And when teaching about Russia and the Soviet Union, be sure that you teach the ideologies as legitimate, not as something evil in the Cold War that we should hate and not like, but try to get the kids to understand what these ideologies were. So I got into it. It sealed the deal for me, really, because I started off by darkening the first day of the Russian unit, Marx unit. I darkened the lights in my classroom, pulled the shades down, and started to lecture on Marx and trying to convince my students that Marx had good things to say. And so that happened over 5 or 6 weeks, and by the time we finished, we had done a Soviet education day, dressed up as Soviet students, acted the whole day with kids teaching each other and being students, going out in the front of the school and exercising. So the Main Street could see the kids in Soviet pioneer uniforms doing that. And it was absolutely wonderful. And for the 7 years I did this before I resigned and then came back to the school system, it was just one of those kind of wonderful things to do. And I got no flack, even though it was the Cold War, because my kids could have, you know, we think they might have become communists themselves, but as far as I know, none of them ever did.
Well, but I was going to ask about that because, you know, that wasn't too long after McCarthyism and where communism and socialism was a dirty word. I mean, I was a school child in the 60s and we certainly did not get presented with the idea of Marxism as a legitimate philosophy or a legitimate way of thinking about the world. So where were you that this was able to pass, that you were able to do this?
Well, I was in New Hampshire, which was a very red state at the time. And when I went to social studies meetings with my New Hampshire colleagues on a state level, I pretty much was the only one sitting on the left side of the room. But I was teaching in Hanover, New Hampshire, where Dartmouth College is. And I think that was one of the spaces that I could do this. And I never got any flack, no letters of the paper or anything. And I think maybe my department had protected me. I don't know. But it was the kids were really into learning. And it was all about learning about the Russians, learning about the czars, learning about communism and Marxism, and getting to understand it. And I think that's what it was. I think because it was honest, I wasn't trying to pull wool over anybody's eyes. It was very honest. And it got me to that, really, those years got me to say, my goodness, I am going to go to that country. I'm going to find out what's really going on in the Soviet Union, because all the propaganda that they were the best nuclear power and they were, you know, communism is going to build the future and all these things happening. I said, it must be something more going on. And that's what got me interested. And so for the next decade of the 70s and 80s, I taught again about Russia and Marxism and stuff, but different ways because the times were different. And in 1985, I said, after having Soviets come to my classroom, I said, I'm going to go for myself. So I got a leave of absence, believe it or not, from the school system for 2 weeks to go to Leningrad, Kiev, and Moscow with Bridges for Peace from Norwich, Vermont, which was doing 10% of the Soviet exchanges at the time, and went for my first trip. And from then on, I was hooked. I came home 2 weeks later in a cloud, and I talked to hundreds of people at the Dartmouth Auditorium and went to libraries and talked and radio interviews. I had my 15 minutes, or let's say 3 minutes of fame at that time. And I said, okay, I'm going back as a teacher. And I did, for 4 schools, 3 cities, English in Leningrad, Moscow, and Almaty, Kazakhstan on the Chinese border. It was an incredible series of experiences. The stories are surprising. I think readers who I've heard from since its book has been out, it's September 15th, good reviews and good responses. And some of my friends have found out some surprising things about their friends, but that's what you find out in the book, because I had to be very honest about some parts where my editor said, either you're going to tell the story or you're not. So I told the stories. So and it was fun.
So Caroline, when you were a child, Russia was our allies in World War II. Do you remember when and how we came to think of them as the enemy?
I really don't, except, I don't know, you know, after World War II, I was protected pretty much by my family during the war. I mean, we had rationing and so forth and so on, but, you know, in schools, we didn't talk about the war very much, and
yeah.
So,
how, How about you, Frank? Do you recall how that switch actually happened?
Well, you know, as I said, when I was in fourth grade, which was like 1940-something, nine, or I can't remember the exact year. It just came. I also I remember listening to Radio Moscow and wondering what it was all about, but I heard about it. But it was the Cold War only got in my mind basically in my high school years when it started to become obvious in the papers and on the radio what was going on and the tension that was happening. But it got really stronger in the 70s and then 80s with the nuclear threat issue. That was the whole focus I had in the 80s. And it was, but it was like something like, I said, I couldn't believe that because these Russians are so-called communists, that they're bad people. It didn't make any sense to me. That's probably one reason why I wanted to go and be there.
And really know, and get to know, see it firsthand.
Yeah. And I wanted to get, as I kept saying to myself, I want to get behind the Iron Curtain. But the Iron Curtain was easy. I just flew over it and was behind it. But then I realized that the Soviet government put this barrier up. They put us on in tourist buses. They put us in special hotels where no Soviets were allowed, special restaurants, went to all the famous places, and we were in this cocoon as tourists. That's what we were supposed to be. Of course, that didn't happen to me, but that was the idea. And I came up with the idea in writing about the Red Veil, that it was like the red in front of us, like go to Red Square, and it's just magnificent, and it just takes your breath away. But what was behind that? What's in the back streets? What's in the flats in the Soviet people? And that's what I wanted to find out, and I did 20 minutes off the plane. Right off the plane, I ended up speaking to a Russian woman and her children, and I ended up in her flat 2 days later, and I wasn't supposed to. And it wasn't supposed to happen all the way along in those 2 weeks. That's why I came home with wonderful stories, which the book talked.
You know, Frank, I was curious as I was reading that story about that woman that you met right off the plane. Why was she there at the airport? What was she looking for?
She was looking for an Englishman. That's what she said to me in Russian, and I understood it because of my 10 days of Russian, as you read. But he wasn't there, and so she ended up giving me her phone number and her name. I don't know why, because there's 19 of us in the group, and she picked me because I think that it was like – sometimes I think it was like destined that I had to meet a Russian, a real Russian, right away. Because the next day I ended up meeting two more real Russians who took me far afield to find some people I was looking for. It was just remarkable right away. And I was off the tour most of the time, I think. So
maybe you looked like what she thought the Englishman that she was there to meet.
Being English and Irish and Scottish, maybe that's true.
Yeah.
So, just popping. I mean, wild, curly hair.
But you never found out, like, how she had connected with this Englishman that she was looking for or anything about it?
I didn't have enough Russian to have real serious conversations, but we communicated very well. It's amazing what you can do in a foreign country if you just let yourself do it without the language, a lot of language. You can find out an awful lot of things.
Well, I was curious about that, how you, without knowing much Russian, how you felt confident in this really foreign country with no real protection to go off the tour and go out on your own and be confident that nothing bad would happen.
Well, I received an email from a woman who lived in St. Petersburg for 15 years, and she was astonished looking at my book that I could get on the metro on my second day in Russia and find my way to another part of the city, get out and find my way to an address. She said, I still can't find people's addresses after 15 years, and I have no idea. I know where the metro was, and I was going to go to Petrogradskaya, so I went down this long escalator and got on this metro and got off somehow, not reading Cyrillic very well at all, and got to her apartment on the fourth floor. It's like someone was taking me by the hand and just leading me along, or the leash, and I got there. it was just one of those things when I kept going back to visit with her when I returned and got to know her and her family and her two kids. So it was, I don't know how, why it happened. Somebody, I look back and I say, sometimes if you believe in miracles, maybe that's one. I don't know.
Did you ever become fluent in Russian?
No. I was teaching English in schools most of the time, and I had to use English, and the kids couldn't use Russian in English class because I didn't have enough to use. So I got them to speak better English, I think, and that's what I did. But I still, it's funny, I would have dinners with Russians who would spend 3 days getting ready for a feast for their foreign friend, and they would speak Russian, and I swear to God, I understood everything they said. But I woke up the next morning not knowing a thing. So I guess it was the vodka at work. I don't know. But it was a lot of fun. I never had any problems. I always felt welcomed. I always felt, and when I got to some families to get to know, I felt like I was part of the family. And it was just one of those things that each time I went, I loved every minute of it. And I went one more time after communism closed in 1994 to the new Russia. But I saw the same Soviet Union 3 years later. It's just almost the same mess, the same problems, the same potted roads, gutted pothole roads and rusty garages and warring flats and all that stuff was still the same. Russian poverty was pretty bad among the people, I think. It was pretty poor. But all the people were sort of in the same boat. It's kind of interesting. And they all thought they were in a good boat until later. Began to find out about the West when Gorbachev came in. They began to learn a lot more about what life was like in the West, which was not like theirs.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Frank Toms, author of Behind the Red Veil. Mom, do you have some questions?
Well, I was curious about his conversations with the students. Not in class necessarily, but just, well, maybe it was in class, but what were some of the things that the students said that surprised you?
Well, that's an interesting question. A lot of times, Cafe Tarakan, which is the Cafe Cockroach, was one of the favorites of the students of the first school I went to. I'd have conversations and they'd tell me things about how they cheated on their exams, how they prompted each other, which I experienced in class I would teach. And if a kid didn't know an answer, the rest of the kids would whisper to the kid the answer, which was a surprise. They would and blatantly whisper so the teacher could hear me in this case. And I was surprised about a lot of different things about the culture and what they thought about, really thought about their school and their teachers. But some of the students were very serious about their work. And I learned in a recent conversation with a Russian, former Russian student at my first school, that she said a lot of the students did not do the things that I say in my book about cheating or prompting because they took their work seriously and they got a good education. And they did. So in my book, I don't think I emphasized enough of how many some kids behave. But I kept hearing about the issues of prompting and whispering to each other in class, whether it was in Kazakhstan, Estonia, or in Leningrad, or in Moscow. It was all over, and now it still happens. Kids in different time zones electrically pass on exam questions to kids in time zones. There are about 9 time zones now in the Soviet Union, in Russia, and they pass on questions and answers to each other electronically. It's a very deeply embedded collective culture that supports each other. The cheating is done for other people, not for the person him or herself. Very different than I think when I found cheating issues in the U.S., the kid was cheating for himself to get a higher grade. Right. In fact, I did that once as a student. I looked at other person's answers on an exam that I didn't know the answers to. I admit that it was a horrible feeling afterwards, and I didn't take any advantage of what I did, but I did actually do it for me. But they seemed to do it for each other, and it was the collective culture was really deep, and that's all that comes through in the book pretty clearly. I think. I hope.
So the students were helping one another so that the school could look could appear to be successful, correct?
That's a very good observation, Caroline. Yes, I think that's true. Everybody was in it. The Soviet educational system from Moscow was oppressive. It was huge. Every day students get graded in class. Every day there's homework. And there's about 7 or 8, 9 classes a day and 5 or 6 or 7 subjects, depending on the year and what's going on. Just is overwhelming. Teachers were overwhelmed. The students were overwhelmed. And the pedagogy that Soviets used was basically a retelling pedagogy. The kids would read the textbook, retell the textbook, and then get credit for retelling the textbook. There was no students would stand to answer questions and then sit down, stand to answer and sit down. There was no dialogue except for the very good teachers who did that. And I got to meet some of those people who just broke the pedagogical thing, which I saw nationally, by the way. I saw it in Estonia. I saw it in Moscow. I saw it in Leningrad. I saw it in Kazakhstan. The same pedagogy, the rapid repeat retelling, except for those teachers who wanted to hear from the kids, which is the kind of teacher I had been all my life. And I got to be very good friends with some of those teachers. So it was fascinating, but the schools needed to look good. That's for sure. Caroline, you nailed it.
Well, it was interesting to me. It really was that part of it, because it was really an experience you had. I mean, that's just amazing what you were able to do.
And I was lucky
to connect with the students like that, you know?
Oh, yeah. And teachers. I had more interesting private conversations you can shake a stick at. I just was very, very lucky. They somehow, I decided that as I'm in the reading, I'll give you in a few minutes whenever you want it, about being a vulnerable person myself, and that which let them be vulnerable with me. I think that's what happened. If I had come, you know, waving the American flag and putting America onto them, I think they would have just stood back and waved the communist flag back. So.
Right, right.
Frank, how many of the Russian students were learning English, were studying English?
Well, there are 23 special English language schools in Leningrad at the time. And all the kids in special English language schools would learn English. And most of the kids were all they all entered school in first grade in a form, like form 1A, 1B, 1C. There are about 30 or 40 of them. And they would stay together through, I think, the eighth grade, and then they would be reshuffled or sometimes for the last 2 years, sometimes. But English, the language, they divided into smaller groups of 15 each. So, and they would have, and the special English language schools, they'd have English every day. Some schools had English for kids every day, and then other kids only once or twice a week, depending on what they thought their level was. So I got to teach classes around 15 children each. And it was very, you know, and they got good at them, I'll tell you. By the time they were 16, they were speaking really good English. I'm really impressed. Even though it was the most boring pedagogy to teach it, it really was. If you followed the pedagogy, it was terribly boring, but it was drill and kill. And if they're used to that in a communist culture, which comes from the top, the drill and kill kind of fit the culture. And I never said that in the book, and I should have. It kind of fit the culture. And so they learned. And the kids were, most of the kids were good, except there's a story about Luda in the book who didn't know squat about English. And she'd stand up to answer, and she put her eyes at 2 o'clock, like waiting for her brain to tell her what the answer was. And the kids would prompt her and whisper. And then she would give the correct answer and sit down. But she never learned the language.
Wow.
She repeated what her prompting friend said to help her. But they helped her become to stay uninformed and not to learn the language. It's ironic. I thought that was a phenomenal. I told that story in the book because it's kind of interesting how the collective at the same time is supportive. It also lends itself towards mediocrity. Nobody can be an exception.
Are there also advantages to the collective that you saw?
I think so. If kids are having trouble, you never have kids stay after school. Not one child ever stayed after school with a director in any school that I knew of, because one child is never responsible for his behavior. His collective is responsible for his behavior, and he is responsible for the collective's behavior. So when a whole group of kids skipped class, and then they came into the class 5 minutes before the end of class, and the assistant, the teacher, my supervisor in English who was there, scolded them, and I thought, well, I was sure I knew the kid who led them out of the school, and the kid totally denied it. He said, we decided. I didn't decide. We decided. And it was we. So you're not going to keep the whole group in a detention. If you had three forms of detention, you'd have 120 kids in the assembly hall staying after school. So it was fascinating. So they nurtured each other, supported each other, grew up together with each other, helped each other get to school on time, helped each other with their homework, helped each other with exams. They were very close. And I really love that about being with those kids. They were close to each other.
So the kids stayed together in the same class
Yeah. The
whole way through eighth grade. Now, what about teachers? Did teachers follow them? I know here in where my daughter-in-law teaches, they've started experimenting with the teachers staying with kids for two grades.
There's a class tutor, one teacher in the school in Moscow, the Teachers and Mothers of the State, that's in the book. This teacher was with her kids for 5 years. And I think from third grade to five or six years. And she was the mother hen. She took them on vacations. She took kids in who had problems with their parents. She was their second parent. She was their babushka, the grandmother of the children. And they loved her. They came to see her after school and talked with her. Her room had a piano in it. They would play piano and they would break all the rules about how to behave in terms of what they're supposed to do in the hall, and put on their armbands and stuff. They were just very loose with her, but they were her kids. And she almost cried telling me that she would no longer have them the next year. But she would have a new group and would start again. But she would still see her old kids on their birth, on the opening of school and other days. But it never happened because she left the country and went to Sweden. So that's a whole other story. Fascinating story about Zoya and Natalievna. Fascinating.
Okay, I wanted to ask something. If the children, the students were all supporting one another, were there classes or anything for the special needs children, or were they put in the regular class and then supported by the other children?
Two things I never saw. I never saw a student go to the library to do research because there were no books to research in the library. And one school I was in, the library was locked because the librarian didn't come to school for 6 months. But secondly, I never saw anything to do with special ed at all. It was all the kids in any form. In the special English language schools, they probably had to find a way to get into the schools. But the regular schools, which I was in also and visiting, all the kids were mixed together. Very heterogeneous, which I haven't actually liked a lot as a teacher in America. The more heterogeneous as my classes were, the better the classes were, I thought. I had both kinds of classes. And I really liked the mix of special ed kids in my class, as well as kids who were really sharp, because they really could nurture each other if you were willing to spend time making that happen. So
that's really wonderful when you think about it. I mean, not to make the ones that are needing help feel, you know, like outcasts. I mean, that's really great. It really is.
Yeah, I think it is good. It's also like the, which I didn't write about in the book, about the Soviet ambulances which were driving around the city. I got to see in a couple of them. There's nothing inside. So it was like there's an ambulance, but there's no bed or equipment or anything inside for people. And it's like the schools. There's no room for supporting kids who really need kind of help. Like this girl, Luda, I talked about. She really needed a lot of help. but there was no, it didn't happen. It all was done in the collective, which I actually liked, but I had a feeling it also probably didn't help some kids who probably could have used it. I'm sure there were dyslexic kids in Russian and kids who had real serious difficulties. And I think, I believe now that I remember, there were some places where kids who were seriously disabled went to as a whole school. I think that, I believe that's true. I remember. I didn't recall that. Sorry.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Frank Toms, author of Behind the Red Veil. Frank, why don't you read a little bit from the book for us today?
Well, I'd be delighted to read it. I'm going to read from bookends. I'm going to read a little bit, some from the beginning and some from the end.
Great.
So I hope it will lure you to think about going and finding out what's happening in the middle, because there's a lot of things that happen. So this is from the introduction, which is very personal. Anyway, here we go. I grew up in a world of mechanical toys with backs and bottoms and tiny metal tabs that invited prying. Some were wind-ups that whirred and buzzed in unpredictable directions. Others stood still, playing tin drums or running strings around pulleys. Most were made in Japan. I played with them, took them apart, and reassembled them. I would peer through the narrow, hardboard slits at the back of my Motorola table radio. I applied gentle pressure to the on switch until it clicked to see the orange glow alight in vacuum tubes, bringing in the sound. I was part of its creation. The front had a dark brown glazed plastic Phoenician design. Hidden openings let out the sound. Late at night, I would spin the right-hand knob, sliding its red-line dial at the top behind clear plastic. Stations having static slid by until I came to WROW, 590 AM in Albany, or WTRY, 980 AM in Troy, broadcasting from New York over the Taconic Ridge. No presets, nothing automatic. And no worries except Mom, who might discover my late night listening to The Inner Sanctum or The Jack Benny Show. The radio was mine and sat in its special place on the shelf by my pillow. And I discovered Radio Moscow, fascinated more by where it broadcasted from than with its content, which made little sense to me. The Motorola was my private ticket to life behind, beyond my family and the small inn where I grew up. Perhaps it was my childhood curiosity with mechanical things that provided tabs for my mind to pry beneath the obvious, particularly when it came to the secrets of Russian and Soviet history and culture. A friend asked me after I returned from my first trip, why would you, Frank, who claim to be interested in understanding your inner self, choose to do it in one of the most inaccessible countries on the planet? A baffling question. I intended to travel behind the Iron Curtain to meet real Russians. I wasn't thinking about me, yet her question provoked me to realize I would have to reveal myself to Russians if I expected them to do the same to me. Were I not to, I would not have a chance to know them beyond external niceties. Another way to say it, if I were to guard who I was, the Russians would emulate that posture. I would have come home able to share only what I'd observed, not what I could have learned from the people. And since childhood, I had a bored feeling outside. I had always wanted to belong. And to do that, I had to become vulnerable. Behind the Red Veil, An American Inside Gorbachev's Russia is a cultural memoir, accounts of my interactions with Russians, mostly through teaching in Soviet schools. I sought to uncover the spirit of a people who were emerging, temporarily as it was, from centuries of living under Tsarist and communist totalitarianism. As readers, You will travel alongside this American in his search to know himself as he sought to understand the lives of the Russians in the last days of Soviet society, their customs, hopes, fears, revelations, heart and soul. And from the coda, the last paragraphs of the book. The Gorbachev thaw lasted nearly 7 years, my years mingling with Russians. And behind the red veil, an American inside Gorbachev's Russia, you've ventured alongside this American who was told his story of seeking out the Russian people everywhere he could and seeking to know himself in the process. My relations with Russians became unwritten contracts in which each of us trusted the other to speak honestly in our encounters. And the more I came to know them, the more I fell in love with them, even with those with whom I had a falling out. I have taken the responsibility to write compassionately because they opened their hearts and minds countless times in countless circumstances, and they opened mine. There you have it.
And that was Frank Toms reading from his memoir, Behind the Red Veil, An American Inside Gorbachev's Russia, which is just released from Spark Press. Have you maintained contact with any of your friends from that time?
Yeah, oh, yes. Yes, I just had a conversation last week with a former student who has a piece in the book that she gave me called The Green Jacket, one of the most interesting stories in the book. And she and some Russian friends read it. They liked it, liked my curiosity, but they also had criticisms, which of course this was, and good ones. I mean, about that I have a chapter called She, where I don't name the student, but they figured out who it was because it's the only student they knew that went to Sweden. It's not the only one I knew. But anyway, that was a criticism in one sense. But I said, she, the girl, and I had communicated, and I could use her name or not. I decided not to use her name because I thought it was interesting to have a chapter with no names as a writer. And she was concerned about the prompting and cheating, that wasn't true for everybody all the time. And I said, yes, et cetera. But otherwise, it was, it's one other point she made too. I can't remember what it is. But basically speaking, I'm going to speak with her and her Russian book club friends in California and hopefully have some really good conversation where I can learn a lot. And one of my best friends moved to Moscow and he had COVID and his wife had it worse, but she's getting better now. And he and I stay in close touch, and several other people. So, and people who I went to Russia with or to the Soviet Union with in America, I stay in close in touch with, especially those with whom I went to a pioneer camp in Almaty in July 1990.
Why was Gorbachev's reign so short? What happened to that? I don't remember that period.
I think he went too far too quickly, too fast, and it didn't work, and things didn't come together, and he was forced to resign on Christmas Day in 1991, and then Yeltsin came in, and he was kind of a drunk, and Putin slowly was sliding his way into power, which he did a few years later, and it just got back to the old ways. Gorbachev, I think he just went too far too fast is a simple answer. If I read more about his time, I might be able to give you a more informed answer, but he really pushed the envelope with people to look at themselves and look at their society seriously, rather than to accept it as the communist leaders said you're supposed to accept it. He opened up that, and boy, did he open it up.
You know what really I'm curious about is what motivated him to do that? You know, he really changed the world.
It's a good question. I should read his biography, which I probably will someday, to find out more about that. But he definitely had, he really saw a society that was not giving what it said it was giving. We're going to build communism, and communism hadn't moved, really. It's the same old thing. At the 11,000 Communist Party members at the highest level had a lifestyle that was beyond belief, and the rest of the people had had to pick up the loose pieces and go to the produce store and maybe bring home one vegetable, maybe two if they're lucky, one roll of toilet paper, things like that. It was just hard riding tired buses that smoked and steamed and tilted, and it was rough. And the subway, which had nice chandeliered stations underneath ground, sort of palaces for the proletariat, but they were underground and people could only be in them in passing. They weren't a palace they really could live in. So
why did you never go back after 1994?
Because of the COVID.
No.
COVID kept me out. I was going back last spring. I was going to go back and visit with friends in Leningrad and St. Petersburg, but that got canceled. So I had it all set up. I'm going to see school friends and teachers and meet my friend from California there, but it didn't happen. So, I'm going to go back if I stay alive and strong, as I'm trying to do at my age. I will do it, but the COVID has to be over first.
I was going to say, as I recall, Gorbachev had a whole different, his countenance was one of friendliness and he had softness about him, which we were not used to that because of what we had seen before and what we're seeing now too. And I think that was part of his appeal, wasn't it?
I think you're right. A lot of the, one teacher resented Raisa, his wife, for dressing so well, because Soviets like to all be somewhat the same, and she was a little too exceptional for this one woman I talked to, a woman who talks about the role of lying in Soviet education in the book. And she said, when I was in America, she was an exchange teacher in America I talked to in New York. I was their chaperone for a week in the city before they went back to the Soviet Union. And she bought no shoes, no dresses, no clothes or anything from America because she didn't want to go back and look and be different from her colleagues. And that's why she resented Raisa for doing the same thing. Very interesting. Mm-hmm. Other people did buy stuff, but she wouldn't. She had a real principled thing. I'm not going to be different from my colleagues at home when I get home. Wow. But of course, she was different because she got to go to the U.S. But.
Yeah. But that's another example of kind of suppressing individualism.
Yes, exactly.
And, yeah. And self-chosen. Elevating. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Frank, I know you were keeping a diary during this time because there's some excerpts from that in the book. Did you always intend to write a book about these trips?
Well, I got it by the end of 88. I decided I was going to do that. And I wrote a whole manuscript between 88 and 90, which got lost. Third of it got lost, but it was bad writing anyway. And I revised it 5 years ago when the Russians became more interested up in the news. I said, well, I got a story to tell. And I really dug into my notes and my pictures and my images. And I just had an absolute ball putting it all together and recalling and remembering. I created a lot of the conversations. I tape recorded, like the one with Raisa talking about my last conversation with one of my favorite teachers. I recorded it and so I told her that I did in the end, so she knew, so I could use it if I wanted to. I really did recording because I wanted my memory to be good. That's why I did that. And I did some clandestine recording with my Russian friend in conversation last week, said that was a no-no. But that was, you can't do that here. I can't record you. You can't record me without telling me, which of course you
did.
Yeah. But in the Soviet Union, half the society spied on the other half. So I was just trying to spy for myself. I never used the information except to transcribe the recordings and then use the transcriptions in my writing. And I lost some of the transcriptions and I threw away the tapes. So it was only that's okay. The tapes are only for me. So.
So you wrote this manuscript years ago, put it in a drawer, or did you try and publish it at the time?
No, I thought about publishing, but when Gorbachev resigned, I said, forget it. Pundits were saying that Russia will be a democracy, it won't be communist. And I said, that's never going to happen in my mind, but nobody will believe me, so I'll just put it away. And so I just put it away and went back and became a teacher again in a private school, Russian history with eighth graders. So, and that's what I started doing again for another 9 years before I became a consultant.
Wow. And when you pulled this, when you decided 5 years ago that maybe it was time to look at this story again, how long did it take you to, did you start with that manuscript or did you just sort of start over?
I started over. I looked at it and said, forget it. I had about 7 or 8 different book titles and stuff, but now I just started over again. I used some notes from things from it and looked at some of ideas, but I just started digging in again and it was really wonderful. I had a great time. I'm a kind of writer that writes sentence by sentence, paragraph by paragraph. I don't do a first draft and then go back and rewrite it. I'm constantly composing and revising at the same time. That's my way of writing. That's the way I did. And every time I did, I kept digging deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. And each time I looked at the paragraph, I would change words. There's one paragraph about the mausoleum and the Red Square. I think I did about 30 drafts before I got it the way I wanted it. And even then, at the last minute, I changed one more part. So, just the way it is for me.
So you don't move on to the next section until you've perfected that
well,
one?
Well, I go as far as I can and then move on to the next and come back and then move on to the next and the next and next, then go back again. And I just have this dialogue with myself, which digs deeper into my mind and my memory and my thinking.
Ah. So did you end up recalling things that you didn't even realize? That you
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure. And I'm sure some of the memories are my fabrication of that time. I'm sure some people who were there would say, well, no, it wasn't that way. That's what memory's like. And if you write a memoir, you give the memory that you have. And if someone else doesn't agree with you, they can write their memoir and tell another story. Because our mind does funny things. It puts things together that are not together. I can't find my weekly reader map on Google that has a red Soviet Union, but another friend of mine remembers the same thing. So to me, it was a red thing on that wall map in my classroom that I remember deeply. But my weekly readers in the 40s and 50s, I can't find a red Soviet Union on Google. Now, I didn't look that hard. But,
yeah, there's a couple things when you're talking about that. One is, do you know... Do they still have weekly reader in elementary school?
I don't know. I'm not sure.
I don't know either.
I remember it
very. Oh yeah, it was a great thing. And
you would have been one of my students, I'm sure. In the '60s, you would have been, and you would have learned about Marxism in a way that you might not have liked. Or maybe you would have. I don't know.
Maybe. The other thing is that I probably would have been pretty open about it. I probably would have been open to learning about it. By eighth grade, I would have been. But, you know, the red signifying communism. And yet now we have red states and blue states, and the red signifies kind of, in some ways, the opposite of communism. Although, if you look at political ideology as more of a circle than a line...
Well said. Red states come around, and boy, they meet the communist. That's fascinating.
Yeah.
We could go into that for a whole other hour, but that's a wonderful image. Well done, Monica.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you. Yeah. So far, right, it's left. So far left, it's right. In either way, it's the authoritarianism is where they seem to meet up. And why do you think? Why are Russians so susceptible to that authoritarianism? I know it's, 600 years of history, but...
It's just the habit. Father, Tsar, Father, Mongols took over Russians while the Europeans were doing the Renaissance. The Russians were looking to the Mongols and who were controlling Central Russia. So they missed the whole Renaissance time. They're all used to somebody telling them what to do and how to do it. It's just deeply embedded in the psyche, I think. And that's why Putin was able to come back so strongly and quickly. He's losing some clout now, which is interesting, but he was up to 80% approval at one time. Not so now, but he was. And it's just, I think it's embedded. I think our culture is embedded in us too, in the States, and we have some struggling to get out of some of the things that we're in. So.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's not all good anywhere. Now in the '80s, we saw Russia, you know, Reagan talked about Russia or the Soviet Union as the evil empire. Were they being told the same thing about America?
Oh yes. Exactly. When I go to classes, the kids will say all these horrible things about the States, homelessness and capitalism and rich and poor and all that stuff. Oh, yeah. But I was able to get beyond that as much as I could.
So once you had this manuscript that you were working on, how did you go about getting it published?
I met April Eberhardt at a San Miguel Writers Conference, who gave me Brooke Warner from Spark Press, and the rest is history. Ed was very lucky, actually.
That's great. Now, you've published books before, but they were very different.
Yeah, they were.
Yeah. Was your writing process similar in those books that are more about teaching?
Similar, but not as deeply as it was in this book.
You said not much had changed when you went back after the dissolution of the Soviet Union, but had people's attitudes changed at all?
I don't know. My friends are my friends. I still like the same people. I don't see much difference. I mean, Misha's in Moscow. He's working for McKinsey and Company, and he's still, you know, same warm, sensitive person he was when I knew him.
Now, you've moved to Mexico, so... you must really enjoy getting deep into other cultures.
I do. And I'm enjoying it here immensely, although we're kind of isolated right now. But I love this culture, and I've learned to live with it with great joy, just like I did in Russia, just like I did in England when I spent a year in England. So, yeah, it's fun being inside another way of seeing the world.
Where would you still like to go and learn about that you haven't had an opportunity to do?
Oh, God, I've got 1% left on my thing. I'm sorry. I'd like to go to Scotland, which I've never spent much time in, and other parts of Europe. I've been to different places, but to dwell inside another culture, this may be the last place I'll do it. Because after all, I am 82 now and living life well, and I want to keep going, and I probably will never immerse as much again, but I certainly have enjoyed that process in my life.
Well, what was the hardest thing about immersing into the Soviet culture for you?
I didn't find it hard right from the beginning. I just had fun being myself and jumping around and being naive and letting my naivete let me get into places I didn't belong. So.
All right. What advice would you give someone who wanted to go to Russia now?
Let COVID be done, get a visa, and go and see it for yourself. It's they're very open to foreigners, and you'll probably get a red veil view, a different kind of red veil view, unless you decide to really probe. But what people come back who have gone in recent years have really liked what they've seen. So.
Yeah, I bet. So, Frank, you mentioned that you're living in Mexico now. Where exactly in Mexico, and how do you like it there?
San Miguel de Allende is in Guanajuato, and that's where we are. We have a city with a lot of expats, so there's a lot. English is very good here, works well. It's very culturally energetic, well, it was until COVID, energetic place. Wonderful.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Frank.
It has been a joy. Yeah, you are a marvelous interviewer, and your mother is insightful. Wow. I'm really impressed with both of you, and I wish you well in your work.
Damam, do you have some words, some closing words for us today?
Well, this is from his book, actually. It's from one of the people that he was, you know, involved with there as a teacher. And she said, you know, you can do whatever you want with people. Everywhere. That's the most tragic thing. You can turn people into a crowd, then turn into a herd, then lead them wherever you want. It can happen in any country, in yours as well, unfortunately.
Oh, wow. We had a few technical difficulties here, but I'm glad that we were able to talk with Frank in Mexico. And it was interesting to me, this is one of the first times I've actually kept someone on camera on Skype while we were recording. So I got to see him and he was seeing me. And it's different. It is definitely a different experience than just doing it on audio. So maybe someday we'll switch to a video podcast as well as an audio one. But that doesn't work for radio. See you all next week on Writer's Voices.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
All right, take care. Bye-bye. And stay well and stay safe, okay?